I just coughed up a jalapeno.
Dying.
You just want to make it hard for me to edit, I know.
Sonata. Dylan. And you.
Good afternoon, good evening, good night, good whenever, I don't know. I always, whenever I start doing that, I always feel like, what is it, what's the movie, the Truman Show?
Is that? In case I didn't see you, good evening, good afternoon, and good night.
Yeah, good afternoon, good evening, or good night, yeah. I didn't steal it from that, but it just feels right. You're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast. This is episode 19. We're going to be talking about Google Amp later this evening. But first, I am your lovely, lovely host. I just got a haircut today, so I'm even lovelier than normal. My name is Michael, the beard man Feenan. I don't know.
Did you get your beard cut?
No, I just got the top of my head cut, because, yeah. I'm nine months into this beard, man.
That's commitment. I'm Aaron Hill. I don't have Feenan's beard.
Nobody asked you to.
I didn't have a haircut either, but I do have a vodka tonic.
Oh, nice!
With lime juice, lime juice.
Have you ever like taken a sprig of rosemary and stuck it in the?
I haven't, but now I want to.
Yeah, it gives you that little I don't even know how to describe that herbescence. I don't know.
Herbaceous.
Herbaceous. There you go.
Is that the word?
You, okay. You're on the same page with me. I'm having scotch because, duh. There was a new one. I went to my friendly local neighborhood liquor store the other day, and they had a new scotch on the shelf, Tomaten, not to be confused with tomato tin or whatever. Like I had to look up how to say it because I genuinely was not sure. It's Tomaten. It's a Highland scotch. It's an 18-year-old scotch, the one that I got. It's very interesting. It's a very hot scotch. They bottle it at 46%, and it's got a very kind of rosy type of flavor that I associate with Speyside. I'm still deciding how much I like it. It's definitely not the best 18 I've had, but it's also not the most expensive 18 I've had. So I'm gonna get through the bottle and see. I mean, not the whole bottle tonight, but eventually get through the whole bottle and see. You know, maybe if it gets a place on my shelf for a while.
So I've got a funny digression about 46%. I, first time, and I think last that I ever had Everclear, I hadn't had it before, and I looked at the bottle, and I saw the percentage, and it says, you know, like 98%. And I remember thinking, like, reading it as the proof, and I was like, oh, well, gin is like 90-something proof. Like, that's no big deal. And so there was like a little bit left in the cap, and I just like drank it, and then my mouth went numb. And I looked at it again, and it's like, oh, wait, 198 proof.
Filed under mistakes you only have to make once in life.
Thank goodness.
when I was in college, we would soak cherries in Everclear. Uh-huh. That was a long time ago now, and now I feel old. Thank you. Speaking of feeling old and things that have nothing to do with that, you can follow us online at Facebook or Twitter. We are /DrunkenUX, or check us out on Instagram now. We are /DrunkenUXPodcast. And we share things there. I try to share some behind the scenes stuff, you know, photos of, you know, editing and equipment and things if you're interested in that kind of thing. So please feel free to.
I want the password.
Damn it. I'm sitting here. I got my clicker in my hand and I'm playing a clicky thing with it. No, I will get you the password. Don't worry. We'll get there. One of these days, I just have a really bad memory about, or memory for, not about, but for doing such things. And speaking of Instagram, I know that you're a memeaholic. Is that the right?
Sure. The it right is
phrase?
Now.
Memeaholic.
As of
we've got
today,
one topic this evening that I think is going to cover that in an interesting way. For our listeners, we're going to change the format a little bit tonight. And so let us know what you think of it, if you like this or not. And if so, we'll maybe do this once in a while. There are a couple things in the news today specifically that I was thinking about what we wanted to warm up with, and I decided, you know what, let's not choose between them, let's run with all of it, and if that takes up half the show, great, and then we'll spend the other half talking about Google Amp and what's going on there. So to start off, Google has decided that they want to take a page from Fox Networks and kill off a much beloved and enjoyed product.
Google Reader?
Yes, but that was a long time ago. But in a fashion, and I'm saying this as I am sitting here literally wearing a Firefly t-shirt. So
he is.
I feel almost like I set this up and that was not the intention. But Google has decided that Inbox has served its purpose.
What?
And by March, it's gone.
Fuck you. Well, they're killing Inbox?
Don't fuck me. It's not my decision.
Oh, no. I've read The Miller's Tale from Canterbury Tales. It's okay to kill a messenger.
They've basically said that, you know, Inbox was always kind of set up as a place for them to test advances to email and features that in some cases did make it into Gmail. Now that they've done like their material redesign of Gmail and, you know, all the other things, they're basically saying, you know what? Yeah, we're happy. We don't think Inbox is necessary anymore.
Those shitbirds. Yeah. I can't believe that.
I have used Inbox since virtually day one.
Yeah, same.
I like it. It works well for the way my brain works.
Mm-hmm.
And this is troubling.
I was just yesterday, I forget what, I was looking through my email, and the feature that I really miss from Gmail, which I guess I'm going to have all the time now, is being able to set up filters that apply labels and then having your stuff organized by labels. I was sad that Inbox never had anything like that. And I was hoping they would bring that in.
I'm all about like the bundling feature that Inbox had.
Yeah, that's nice.
And Gmail has it. I mean, they have labels, but they don't bundle. Like if I've got 20 messages from, you know, a service or, you know, something or part of work or whatever, they basically just fill my inbox up as opposed to all of them getting one line and compartmentalized together.
Well, so what you do is you make a filter that applies a label and skip inbox.
And then I miss the emails.
Well, no, because then you see in your sidebar that, you could see in your sidebar that that particular label is bold and has a number next to it, meaning that
I have too many labels. I have more labels than I have sidebar space. And that maybe is my own fault. I probably maybe should go through and clean up. And that's part of the problem, too, is Inbox came out in, I think, 2014, if my memory is serving me correctly. And
sounds about right.
I have been using it for 4 years. I went back. I decided today, I'm just like, you know what? Okay, fine. I'm just going to rip the Band-Aid off. I'm going to go back to Gmail. If they're going to get rid of Inbox, I'm not going to, like, linger. I'm just going to switch. But my Gmail is such a god-awful mess because of it, because they didn't, like, your labels in Gmail are certainly available to Inbox, but so much of, like, you know, that bundling functionality, the color coding functionality, none of that carries over. Filters work differently. Like, I'm looking at my Inbox right now, and it is just a god-awful mess, and it's going to take me hours to write filters and get it cleaned up to show stuff in a way that Inbox has just been doing for me forever.
Oh my god, I'm looking at mine right now.
It's bad, isn't
Jesus.
It?
Jesus. Yeah. What, that's, now there's like views? What even is this? What's the default? Why is the default view? What does that even mean?
Oh, I know. You're looking under like display density.
Oh my god, and there's like tabs and shit. What?
Oh, it has been a long time since you've looked at it.
Oh my god.
I always hated too with Gmail how you've got these tabs, you know, primary, social, promotions, updates. I can't add. I can take one away. Like I could say, well, I don't want the forums tab. That's a weirdly arbitrary tab to have anyway. But I can't add one in that's like bills. Like how obvious is that?
Oh, that would be awesome.
Bills, because I pay online for everything. Why don't I have all of my bill stuff and statement stuff going into something? In Inbox, I had a bundle that I called finance, basically. So it was anything doing with money. And they all went mm-hmm. that purchases. If I buy something and I get shipment notices and invoices and all that, I had it all going to one bundle.
I really loved how when you would travel, and it would, like, if you bought like a plane ticket and a hotel reservation, it would bundle that all up into one like travel thing. And then it would even like infer information and it would set up calendar remind. Like, that was really cool. I'm going to miss that.
Yeah. And I honestly, since I know you, like, you can hit, you can create like snoozes and stuff in Gmail, but it's genuinely, it's been so long since I've used it. I don't know. I don't know how much of that functionality carries over now. And that's, I guess, the lesson here is even stuff you think is safe. Because Inbox, you know, I know it was always kind of touted as a playground, and it was one of those sort of perpetual beta sort of tools. But it felt like it was different enough from what they were doing with Gmail, and that idea of them trying to rethink the way we use email, that seemed very progressive and something that had a place, and clearly it doesn't. So I don't know. I don't know what to do with that now that that vision has been crushed for me, because
they keep doing this to their user. I was really, I loved Google Reader like so much. I still lament that RSS feeds aren't used nearly as much as they were, because I think the technology, the foundation behind it, is awesome. But I had a thing on Google Reader where if you starred items, you could get an RSS feed of your starred items. And then I had a little PHP thingy that would consume the RSS feed of the starred items, and then I embedded that on my website. And so anytime I wanted to feature a link on my website, I would just star an item in Google Reader when I would read it in the morning. And it was like automatically syndicating content to my blog or to my website. And those fuckers killed it off.
So there's a lesson to everybody. Yep. If you're an Inbox user, go check out the news and prepare yourself. I mean, it's, I doubt they save it. If they didn't save Reader, they're not going to save Inbox. So,
I'm just going to go back using Pine. I'm done.
I think if we wait, you know, I think you're going to see some Inbox features certainly make it into Gmail. Many of them have. I mean, Inbox has had an influence on Gmail, but it's still Gmail. It's still that interface. And going back to it, the other thing I said earlier today to somebody was, going back to Gmail, I feel like I've just walked backwards in time 5 years. It feels so rough. Inbox had an elegance to it that felt right, and this just doesn't. This does not feel right. So that's the lesson. Inbox gone if you're an email user. The other bit of news, and this was the other one that I was like, I can't not talk about this. And you know, I considered maybe devoting an episode of Real Time Overview to it or something, but I think this is a good place to talk about the EU copyright directive. Because as we are recording this early this morning, which would have been afternoon in EU times, they passed the initial reform articles for their EU copyright laws. And this includes the much lauded? That's not the right word. Much derided.
Lauded?
Lauded?
Derided?
Doesn't lauded mean praised?
Yeah.
That's not the what opposite. It was. The opposite of lauded.
So exclamation point lauded.
Articles 11 and 13. This is, for those of you who aren't aware, this is the link tax and the piracy filter.
Wait, what?
Link tax.
Link TAX.
Yeah. Like, if you aren't playing enough Zelda, they are going to charge you extra money. So
yeah, almost had me there. Like hyperlink. Like hyperlink tax. Yes, like, if you click on a link, you have to pay? Or if you have a link, you have to pay?
So, this is the thing that drives me nuts about this is when GDPR was going through, and certainly leading up to its implementation, this was news everywhere. Everybody has been talking about GDPR for the last 2-3 years. People have been talking about Article 11 and 13 and this copyright reform, but I don't feel like it has happened to the degree that we talked about GDPR, and I think the implications of it are much larger as a matter of course, especially for business. And that's not good. And for the folks that are like, well, if we're in the U.S., we don't care. Screw them. Tell that to every U.S. company that is trying to get GDPR compliance in place, because it's a big old internet and we don't operate in a vacuum. And so you can bet, I mean, YouTube's put out statements on this, Wikipedia's put out statements on this, Facebook, they're all, you know, in the game, because it affects all of them. So wait.
What's the jurisdiction here? Like, if, because the internet isn't just in one country, is it? If your data is hosted in a country, then it applies if it's in the EU.
Or... if you are in, it would apply to EU content creators. So it wouldn't apply to
people who live in the EU and create content.
Anybody that is, you know, under EU jurisdiction.
So if someone from the EU came over to the US and made content, would it apply while they were here?
That I don't know. That is a clarification. I admit a slight weakness in the details of EU copyright law, because it's not exactly like the US. With GDPR, for instance, it applies to any data subject, what they call a data subject. And a data subject is any person within EU jurisdiction. So if you went to the EU, a country in the EU, you would be covered by GDPR even though you're an American citizen. And if my memory is correct, if an EU citizen came here, they are technically still covered because
they're a citizen.
Their citizenship grants them jurisdiction as a data subject. I may be wrong about that second part. There are so many little details to that I have not kept straight in my head over the months and months and months of talking about, and that's one that I'm going to reserve the right to be wrong on. With the copyright law, I don't know if the same kind of thinking applies in terms of, like, a subject, as, you know, if you're just in the EU. My guess is no. My guess is that it applies to EU citizens just by the nature of how the jurisdiction stuff on that works.
So is this like the DMCA?
It's very similar in purpose, so to speak. Okay. You know, this is all about, and let me be very clear. Like, I'm not against copyright. In fact, I'm very much for copyright. Sensibly, I am an apostle of Lawrence Lessig. I love the way the man's brain works. I've read, I think, every book that he's written. His thoughts on copyright, his Creative Commons platform, I subscribe to wholeheartedly. This is in that realm of saying, we're going to try to protect people's creations, but we're going to do it in the dumbest way possible. And so whereas Lessig put out Creative Commons as a way for people to establish license parameters on their content for reuse and acceptable use on their stuff, things like the DMCA went the opposite direction, and they went to big business, and they got big businesses' input and tried to write a law that is effectively not designed to advance copyright for the future, but to prop up old business models that refuse to adapt. That's what's happening. Right. And that's what the DMCA did. Yeah. The DMCA was exactly along those lines. The DMCA has been abused up one side and down the other. It has resulted in incredibly bad products being put out. And the thing everybody keeps talking about is the content filtering. Article 13 is all about content filtering. So if you upload any content of any kind to a platform that distributes quote-unquote significant amounts of content, whatever that is supposed to mean, they have to scan it to see if it matches with any other copyrighted work.
So like Content ID on YouTube?
Right. YouTube is infamous for their Content ID system and how awful it is. I mean, it is... in my opinion, a failure as a product because of the number of false positives it creates.
When I worked at IU, we had put up a promo video for an event, and we had paid a company to license a song that they had for use in online video. Like, it was expressly for that purpose. And then our video got flagged by YouTube's Content ID thing because we were using like a song from that company, and we're like,
right, because the system has no way of knowing that you've licensed it. I mean, how right. can it can't take that into account? Yeah. I had a conversation with a friend of mine earlier today about this, and they said the same thing. They're like, "Well, this can't be that bad. We've already got these AI platforms that can scan it." And I'm like, "Yeah, but they're incredibly bad."
You know what the biggest problem is with the content ID thing is that, so like, if you, let's say you make a video and YouTube's content ID filter flags it as being like a Prince song or something for whatever reason, then it will attribute any revenues that the ads make to the content owner of the content they think owns your video, content in your video. And then you can contest it, and that can take a couple weeks. But then when they find it, it's like, oh, no, you're correct. It's just a video of chimpanzees. Like, this doesn't actually have music in it at all. I don't know why this happened. Any revenues that those ads make don't get reverted back to you. They don't put them in escrow. They're just like, we're just going to give them to the media company. It's bullshit.
Yeah, there's a huge gap in terms of who these things benefit. And of course, the DMCA, one of the big complaints about it is the lack of accountability in it from the standpoint of copyright holders. And one of the big problems in the content ID system is people going in and doing giant blanket bans on things and strikes against stuff without ever reviewing the actual content they're hitting. And there are tons of articles of various ways in which this has gone totally and completely awry, from people flagging their own stuff to, you know, like we say, flagging stuff that has legitimate use to flagging stuff that's literally public domain. And they're just trying to strike it down based on nothing. And there's no accountability for it.
I forget who the artist was, but there was a musician who was on a record label, and they had a video up of their own song, and it was flagged as being owned by the record label, even though it was on like one of the record label subsidiary channels. Like it was just, why you do this?
So let's back up just a hair on this and talk first about Article 11. Article 11 is the provision that accounts for the quote unquote link tax. And basically what they're trying to do, and this goes back to what I had started to say about, like, I respect copyright, and I understand that when you make something, you should get paid for it if somebody else uses it. I'm totally on board with that. And the latest the amendment that was part of this that got passed made an effort to kind of clarify this in a way that didn't clarify anything at all. What they're saying is, if you are a platform that links to content, you can't use excerpts from news agencies without a license from them that allows you to do that. Keep in mind, this is completely without respect for any, and same thing will go for Article 13 with what is considered fair use, you know, excerpting a couple sentences, you know, as a teaser to lead into a link, for instance. Sure, I get, like, the idea of copying an article wholesale and having like a little byline at the bottom, but that's already illegal. That's already against copyright law. Keep that in mind.
Right.
But like they've done so in I'm going to read some of this to y'all, and I understand that it's going to be boring because it's legalese, but so the amendment to Article 11, one of them, reads, "The rights referred to in paragraph 1 shall not extend to mere hyperlinks which are accompanied by individual words." And that's all it says. It doesn't say if individual words mean the headline. Can I link to the headline without a license? Do I have to use my own individual words? What if I don't use words? What if I use an image or something stupid? Like, you can tell this was written by somebody who had no understanding of the thing in which they're writing about, you know?
Wait, so, what?
You're a Reddit user, right? You use Reddit.
Yeah. Everybody's
everybody's a Reddit user. You know, think about the number of times, you know, you see people submit articles, and what's the first thing you do when you enter a link into a Reddit post?
But like the headline.
Yeah, it goes in and scrapes the headline and puts it in there.
Yeah.
Does that mean that Reddit can't do that anymore if they don't get licenses from those copyright holders? Nobody knows.
That's stupid.
Nobody.
Like, because you should be redirecting the users to the source content. You know, I think this is going to be one of those unintended consequences, going to shoot them in the butt, because if aggregator services can't cite news agency articles, it's not like news agency articles are the only place to get news anymore anyways. So are we just going to see more like the news coming from other sources as primary sources and then less traffic going to these media? Like, yeah, I think this is...
It's certainly an argument, you know, yeah. And there's happens. So many issues when you think about this stuff in that the whole reason, for instance, the whole reason this problem exists is because people don't understand technology. If you don't want this to happen, write a robot's file.
Right.
If you don't want Google to be using your excerpts and to be linking to your stuff without paying you, then you need to write a robots file to disallow them from doing that and then go to them and work out your contract. That would allow that you would say, I will take down my robots file for you if you pay me money. Yeah. Because that's the whole reason those things exist. That is why we have meta keywords. It is why we have meta descriptions. why we have open graph information is because you want people to share those things. And I would argue that your use of those in your markup is an implicit agreement to allow people to do that.
I can't think of any news aggregator site like Facebook or Reddit or any of them that features content from news sources that is deep enough that I don't need to actually click through to find out the story.
Yeah. You get 180 characters or something like that, 300 at the most. That's not a news story.
If people are just tripping over the headline and not actually clicking through, I guess that's another thing. But that seems like a different problem. And there's arguments to be made about the efficacy of clickbait. I avoid, if there's an article that has a clickbait headline, I will, even if I'm interested, I will avoid clicking on it because fuck them. Like, I don't need to know it that bad.
It really, and yeah, the more you dig into it, the more just sort of bizarre it feels. And there's some information out there, and we'll have some links to this information so you can go do your own research. But, you know, companies like Germany already have considerations for some of these things. In fact, parts of Article 13 are directly modeled on Germany's laws. And everybody will tell you that the approach Germany has taken with regard to linking, interlinking, and content filtering has been not just ineffective, but unproductive. It's not protecting anybody, and the people it is supposed to protect, it isn't generating any revenue for them, which is the explicit reason that this is being done. And yet, here we are with this law potentially, you know, coming up for a vote in January that is going to do the thing that we know doesn't work. It's insane to write law this way. So let's talk about Article 13 then.
That's the restructuring one, or is that the clean slate?
No, Article 13 is the piracy filter one. This is the part where if you post what they call a significant amount, whatever that means, that's where I get to, like, this isn't just bad law in application, but in writing. And here's the other part about this. Keep in mind, this is the EU we're talking about. This is EU member state stuff. So the council could pass this, and once it is passed, it is then the responsibility of each individual member state to then take this and craft their laws based on it.
Oh my God.
So you could actually end up with a dozen different variations on these rules that don't necessarily agree with each other. Keep that in mind, because that's also like a setting for disaster for websites. This is where, so Article 13, and this is where I made the joke about memes, and I think personally the people who have been behind the Save the Internet campaign and the anti-Article 13 campaign, they fucked up, and they did it in a huge way, because when you start looking at articles about this, and even I've seen the actual EU council members refer to it this way, as the war against memes. And I think describing it as a war against memes devalues the topic and makes it be something that people won't take seriously. Because everybody's like, oh, the memes. Like, I'm not like overstating this. It is literally an argument that comes up in articles on The Verge and Gizmodo and places like this. Oh, the memes. Now all the memes are going to get flagged for copyright infringement. And I'm like, that is such small potatoes compared to what the actual implication of this is, that that's not a very good way to go after this. And so for folks who are listening who may be in the EU, for some of our listeners, I urge you to consider that when you talk about this with folks, is that people don't, memes are jokes. And if you're going to model your argument on that, they're going to think of your argument as a joke.
Memes are also not, like, you can have, most of the memes that would be affected are just referential humor or, like, you know, establishing a common thread of a photo that evokes a particular emotive response. I literally did a presentation at PC Elements about this very topic. However,
are memes considered a transformative work of art? Is that?
That's a good question.
I mean, clearly they, you know, clearly we give them a pass. If you go on Imgur and filter by, you know, memes that people create, you know, obviously it's not something anybody's really, you know, trying to take down or anything. I don't know if that's considered transformative. If it's, I feel like that's, like, if you took my photo and used
You'd have an uphill battle on that, but I could see a defensible position about that. Sure. Maybe.
Part of me feels like we need to treat that a little bit more like trademark law, where if you don't defend the copyright, then it is implied that it goes away. That's, you know, if you have a trademark you never use, people can contest that and take it away from you because of that.
So, but like, if you made memes based entirely off public domain imagery or just imagery that was freely licensed, they can be just as effective.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, it may take longer to find them, but I guarantee you that people will release photos into the wild that are meme friendly and will get picked up and used, and that will be fine. It's just that there are other photos right now that are easier to get to and more widely understood, and so people are using them. And like, memes will survive.
Memes, the memes border on this topic, and this is where another place I'm gonna preface what I'm about to say with, I'm not entirely clear how current EU copyright law addresses this, but as far as US copyright law goes, works of parody, satire, or if something is a transformative work, that is allowable under US copyright law, and I know to an extent, in some member states, it's allowed.
You have a defensible position foundation to defend yourself. It's not strictly. I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but I've read a lot about this. It's not specifically like you are carte blanche allowed. It's that if someone challenges you, you can say, because that is your basis for your defender argument.
And AI, content ID. It has no way of distinguishing that. Just like it doesn't know that you had a license for X song or something. Yeah. You know, you could argue that, well, they could add a system when you upload your video or your article or whatever, that you could flag it and include a copy of the license that says, don't flag it for this because here's my license for it. And I could see that argument. I could see that being a reasonable answer to part of that. But it doesn't know parody.
Do you remember when people uploaded, this was like a 2-week period, maybe a month period, when people were uploading the B movie trailer, but every time they would say the word B, it would change how the playback of the trailer goes?
Yeah.
So like every time I say B, it goes faster. So the PBS Idea Channel, Mike Renetta made a video where he would show the full B movie. But every time they said the word B, he would show his like 5-minute intro explaining about the thing he's going to do. It was like so meta. Crazy. But
I thought you were going to go another direction with that, actually, because I remember when the Hitler Reacts video was, I mean, it's still, you know, something people use.
Oh, yeah.
There was that period a few years
from
back.
From Downfall, right?
I don't even remember. Yeah, I think that was the name. Downfall.
Where he's like all angry. I mean, he's angry and everything.
But, it's a great scene. Yeah. But there for a while, the company that produced the movie was throwing copyright strikes against people for that. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, I think that has kind of let up at this point. You know, it's one of those fight the tie.
Yeah.
But it comes back to this idea that I think at some point we
I would say that's transformative, I would say.
I think, yeah, I would argue it is too. Yeah. And I think that's why it ultimately, you know, didn't amount to anything. But I think, you know, as a culture, we need to sit back and start to have an honest conversation about the way content spreads and is used and what makes sense as far as reasonable protection of an author's works. And this is not an honest discussion on that, because when you go look at the names of the companies, you know, this isn't being pushed by people like me. Like I write plays. I'm a theater guy. This isn't me coming in and saying, hey, please protect my plays. This is, you know, associations. This is music generators. I mean, it is like just like DMCA, you know, it's got the backing of major industry players, not people.
Yeah.
And it's not taking into consideration this idea that we're entering a phase where maybe we need to rethink the life cycle of content and what that means.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anybody would defend the idea that you should be allowed to go copy a CNN article wholesale and put it on your site.
Oh, no, totally.
You know, we teach that, you know, that's basic high school English in terms of how you cite stuff and quote stuff. Like,
and that's stupid. I mean, if that's how you're electing to use the internet, then like you're using the internet wrong, because the whole basis of the internet is that you create referential connections, like ideally to primary sources. So it's stupid.
And it comes back to also one of those things that I feel like the people it's going to hurt the most are the people who follow the law, basically. Like the people who don't care are not going to care, and they're going to keep doing what they're doing. And if they get requests, they're going to blow them off. They're going to host their servers in, you know, Russia or Zimbabwe or something, or the U.S. for that matter. And they're going to say, you know what? Psh, we don't care. We're not in your jurisdiction now, so you can't apply.
Right.
And like people have already been raising the question, well, what does this mean? You know, YouTube is the big one, I think, because YouTube is the one that they've already addressed this with their content ID system. And I use that term addressed in a very loose sense. But as a content repository and host, they certainly are the gorilla in this room. And so people are looking at them saying, well, does that mean, you know, are they just going to write a blanket rule that will affect everybody? Because obviously that will be the easiest thing to do. Will they write a rule that only applies to you if you are coming from an EU location? What about people who are consuming content in the EU, but from a person outside? There are so many
questions.
What if you
have, what if your VPN endpoint is in the EU and you're consuming content that posted on?
A whole lot of questions. No answers. There are no answers. And this is why I come back to this argument of, if you think that, oh, it's happening in the EU, so it's no big deal, you are wrong. And keep in mind, these organizations that are pushing for this in the EU exist in the US. And if they see success in Europe and they decide, you know what, it's time to push for stricter restrictions in the US, which they have started kind of poking at, they're going to do it.
Yeah.
And historically, every time the United States has looked at extending copyright law and copyright protections, they have done it.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is scary, because it comes back to this idea that we aren't creating content protection laws that are sensible, basically. We're doing them for all the wrong reasons. This is a business trying to maintain business, not
evolve. You know what it reminds me of is, remember when, like around the Napster, the whole Napster craze, the RIAA, they would cite all this data about all this money that they were losing from music file sharing, but when someone actually dug into it, it was discovered that the bulk of the money they lost was on CD singles, which were already on the decline anyways, because they're just awful. So like they were trying to prop up like an already failing business model by like saying that like this other boogeyman was stealing all their business. But CD singles were a terrible idea to begin with. And if your whole business model is based on that, then maybe your business model is bad.
And it comes back to this idea, and I said it then, and I'll say it now, that, you know, they calculated, oh, all this money lost because they saw all this file sharing. And I always made that argument that, you know what, if when I was a kid and I was using Napster when it first came out and all that, if I hadn't had access to that, those weren't things I was going to go buy.
Right.
You know, you downloaded them because they were available, but not in it. It did not replace something. It was not done in lieu. I was like a, you know, 11, 12, 13 year old kid at that point. Maybe I was a little older, 16, 16, 17 years old. But going to the Juarez sites to download my Alanis Morissette MP3s. Don't judge me.
Same.
But did 16-year-old me really have that money to be going out and buying 20 CDs? No.
Well, especially at $20 a piece, double especially when they cost like a dollar to make, you know? And then you, ultimately they did settle on a good solution, primarily via iTunes and iPods. But still, it was very backwards thinking. They weren't thinking, wow, this compression's amazing, and people can transmit it for free, and it costs us nothing. How can we monetize this? They thought, like, hey, wait a minute.
Well, this is our conversation. This is what Aaron and I have talked about, but I want to open this conversation up to our listeners. So please, after you've listened to this, and if you haven't familiarized yourself with the EU Copyright Directive, go read a couple of the articles we'll have linked. Go pull in some of that information and learn about it. And let us know what your thoughts are. If you are in the EU in particular, I would love to know what your thoughts are and what the conversation actually looks like amongst, you know, EU citizens in terms of this. My impression has been that it is not well supported at all. This has been struck down once, mind you. There was a vote on these laws. What was it, March, I think? I forget now what the exact date was. It was voted down then, but the way law and stuff works there, you know, it kind of simmered and they revised stuff. And then, well, I mean, I say there as if we don't do that in the U.S. and it came back in a revised form. And that's what we saw here. And then they voted on all the amendments and all this. There, the process is for somebody in the EU, even though the U.S. system is kind of screwy, that whole EU council stuff is a whole other ball of wax. So let us know what you think, what your thoughts are. You know, do you agree that news sites should just stop using metadata of any kind and, you know, only allow it to licensed scrapers or something? In the meantime, we're going to take a break. We're going to refill our glasses, and then we're going to come back and talk to you about a whole other topic and discuss Google AMP. So we'll see you back here in about, 60 seconds. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. Are you trying to build a case around an interactive map for your school, city, or business? NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. Their team of professional cartographers specialize in map illustrations and are ready to design a rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all your users' devices with responsive maps that scale and blend in seamlessly with your website. Visit them online to request a demo at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. Thanks for sticking with us here on the Drunken UX Podcast. We just got done talking about the death of Inbox and what's happening in the EU with the EU Copyright Directive and Articles 11 and 13. And now we're going to switch gears to something totally unrelated. Which is Google AMP. But this has been a topic that we've kind of been stewing on for a while, and I've been wanting to talk about it. We've been dealing with it somewhat at my company, you know, the way this impacts SEO and how we are feeding, you know, article and data and everything to Google. And so I thought this would be a neat topic to go into, especially now that it's been around for a couple years, and talk about how everybody else is talking about it. So
Amplitude Media Project.
I have already told you, you are not allowed to rename this.
If Google can kill Inbox, I can rename it.
No, I don't want to live in a world where Google kills Inbox, but lets AMP be a thing. That is just not, I think, a fair trade. That's like knowing, and I'll make this reference again, knowing that Fox canceled Firefly, but then we got like 5 seasons of Two Broke Girls. How did that happen? But I digress, as it were. So
AMP means always murder popular things.
There is an extra letter there, so I would rethink the way your acronym works.
The T is silent.
Oh, T is silent. Gotcha. I should have known. It's my fault, clearly.
Okay. Yeah.
So AMP is, for those of you who don't know, AMP is Accelerated Mobile Pages. Aaron.
I like mine better. I like mine better.
AMP is a project that Google started and then open sourced. I want to say Apache is running it, as a matter of fact. Reserve the right to be wrong. The Tomatin's getting deep with me here, so I may say a lot of dumb things in this half of the show. At any rate, it is open source, but Google is still very much the driving hand on that. There's like, I think the last count was something like 400 to 500 contributors to the project at this stage, but it is still very much a Google product for the most part. And it's something
they'll kill it off in 4 years.
I can only be so lucky. And if that does not give you an idea of where this discussion is going, then I don't think anything will. The funny thing is, too, that, you know, Google's using it. I don't know that other places are. I don't know that Yahoo's using it. I don't know that Bing is using it. And I should have looked that up. It didn't even occur to me before I started saying those words just now. But as far as I know, Google is the only one who has sort of vested themselves into this technology. So what AMP is, AMP itself is a subset of HTML. So it takes our normal HTML tags, throws out most of them, and creates a couple canonical new ones within their reference spec.
So it's RSS. Is that what you're telling me?
It's
RSS.
It's, think of it almost like visual RSS. That might be a way of kind of looking at it.
Are they remaking Google Reader? Is that what you're telling me? Are they remaking
it? No. I need to get you off this Reader kick. Reader is dead. It's not coming back. Go get yourself an account on that. What's the one site? Not
Feedly?
No, my brain is saying NetVibes, and NetVibes is actually the one I left. Maybe it is Feedly.
I had Feedly.
I think maybe it is Feedly, actually. I'll give you credit for that one. No, so what they've done, they've taken this, they've got this subset of HTML. They have limited the amount of JavaScript you can use to a very specific stuff. They limit the amount of CSS you can use. It's a 50 kilobyte limit, which for a lot of folks, you'll realize that 50 kilobytes is not a lot of CSS.
Wait, 50 kilobyte raw or compressed?
At all. So, I mean, white space does take up kilobytes. Bytes, rather. Right. So it would definitely factor into the measurement at that point. It limits the media, the way media works in it. That's images, that's video. And what they're trying to do is take all of that, make a lightweight page that then gets stored on a network of caching proxies all over the world. So if you're familiar with anything, like you use Cloudflare, you use CloudFront, you know, these kind of services, basically there is a thing called the AMP cache, and Google, of course, runs the majority of the AMP caches, and they take these pages. When they see an AMP page that gets requested, they pull it, they store it, and because they feel like they can get it to the user faster than you, and they are probably right about that. In most cases, they are, in most cases, they are right about that. You know, because they have, it's the same reason we use CDNs at all, because we know CDNs get data to people faster. And the point being, you know, they want to get lightweight content to users very quickly. We've spent how many years talking about the importance of speed?
Right.
And, you know, the milliseconds matter. You know, the amount of time it takes to load the page means people leave your site. So that's the point, right? That's why this was a thing. It came out, I think, 2016 was when they officially launched AMP, with this idea of saying, if you take all of your articles and all of your content and put it into these AMP pages, tell us about them. You know, let us, there's a means by which you let Google know that those things exist. They would start prioritizing those in search, which obviously everybody wants SEO optimization. And that's the thing. So Google said, we want speed. We want to emphasize our search. We are going to build a carousel that highlights these AMP articles. They have, since they run Android, Android has a pre-loading mechanism built into it. So when you see search results, for instance, in Android, those articles will get preloaded on your device. So when you go to click on them, that's part of what makes them feel very quick, because it's not downloading after you click it. It's downloaded beforehand. And the unspoken thing here is control. I want to believe that Google is altruistic and believes in the fast web, but I also believe that Google wants to do what is good for Google.
I don't believe Google's altruistic
anymore. we can have that argument at any point, but I think there is a certain amount of control that factors into this, that there's a reason it started as a Google project. There's a reason they continue to be the main driver and control the spec for the most part.
You know, I remember you bringing this topic up as a possible show topic a few months ago, and it was maybe like a few weeks or a month ago. I was using my phone and I was trying to share an article on Twitter, and I didn't have the URL handy, but I knew how to find it. So I searched for it and I found the article, but the link that came up when I clicked on it was an AMP link, and it was like, you know, like I didn't want the Google link. I wanted the original source link. So I had to like click on the thing at the top to get to the source link.
I would love to see user testing for some of those things, you know?
Yeah. And that was my first experience with it, and I immediately hated it. Like, there was the fact that I couldn't easily get the hyperlink I wanted without clicking through to it, which means that it now takes longer overall, because even if it's preloaded, I still have to load the original to get the link. So, and I can't not use it.
That's one of the things. So AMP, you know, it's in the name, accelerated. AMP is all about being fast. And if it's not being fast, it's not really doing its job. And so that's, I think, one of the core questions as, you know, as we look at AMP. And when you go read, and as always, we'll have a lot of articles to reference this stuff in the show notes. So run by the site if you want to check any of them out. When you read articles that support AMP and are telling you to go do it, go set your site up to support it, you know, they all reference the speed is important. The speed is important. But the problem is that they are right and wrong. Speed is important, but saying speed is important is not the same as saying AMP is important for speed.
Right.
And this is where, you know, there's this increasing volume of folks who are saying, you know what, we don't necessarily think AMP is so great. You know, we don't know that it's good that it is a weird, hacky subset of HTML. We don't think it's good that Google is driving it and is pretty much the sole, you know, force behind it. And there was an article, I'm going to have a couple links. One of them's to a CSS Tricks article, and the other is to a fella who's named Ferdy Christent, I think is the name. I may be Tristent. I may be butchering that, whatever. Whichever way. We mentioned his article on a past episode of Real Time Overview, actually. And he looked at a bunch of sort of the quote-unquote controversy that surrounds AMP. You know, why people say it's good versus how it's actually doing. And I encourage you all to go look at some of that, because what we are starting to learn today in 2018, and, you know, 2018 is only 2 years removed from 2016, but, you know, things change quickly in the web. And I don't think Ferdy's article was the one that I originally read, so I'll try to see if I can find the one if it's not. But they were looking at page speed. And they said, let's take an AMP article versus a page that was just purely written to be very quick on mobile devices. And AMP was slower in every test case.
Huh.
Because it's not outside of the caching component.
Yeah.
It has no other true speed edge.
Yeah, this sounds like Turbo Links and Rails. I always disable
it. It's what it is very familiar to, if people know the reference, is instant articles on Facebook. It's a very similar the way it works and everything is very similar to instant articles. But, oh, and speaking of instant articles, there's your use case for the Article 11 link tax. They're reusing the content on Facebook and not driving the users to the author site. So, and what does that mean for AMP? That's also kind of an interesting take on this is Article 13 actually could kill AMP usage, like, completely for EU companies. If I'm not allowed, because it's being hosted and served by a Google property. So if it's not sending you...
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And that comment I made about, you know, is including metadata, sort of implicit consent to allowing people to use that metadata. If that company is providing an AMP link, is that implicit consent to... Because the whole way AMP works is that it is allowed, is that it's cached and served by somebody else. So right. How does that factor in? So there's... Hey, I tied ideas together, guys. I feel so
well.
I feel so good about that. I leveled up. I leveled up and totally lost my place. So how does that sound? No, the idea behind AMP being fast is, I think, losing some of its luster, so to speak. If you just write really good mobile pages and put them on CloudFront, you can produce a page that is as fast or faster than AMP. Period. Like, that's the end of that discussion as far as that goes. Okay. So I don't know. Like, AMP has a lot of challenge moving forward because you can adhere to all of the AMP ideas behind lightweight JavaScript, you know, very little CSS, limit everything on the page. You don't need AMP itself to do that. You could just do it. There's nothing stopping you from that. A lot of their speed also comes from a trick, which is that pre-caching model. If you're on Android and you see those links, or if you go to your Google Now feed, there's a trick happening there, which is if their, you know, little learning network thinks you're going to click on the link, it's going to preload it. And so when you hit it, the data has already been downloaded. That doesn't necessarily make the page faster. It just is a trick of the OS. And I'm not saying it's a bad trick by any means. But it is a trick. It is a trick through and through. And it's a trick that I feel is less effective. I'm still using a Nexus 6P. This is a 3-year-old phone now, I think, right? Maybe almost 4 years old. Let me tell you, AMP links on this phone are not fast.
Yeah. I don't notice any different on mine with an AMP link versus a regular link. Other than that, I have to click through and it's annoying. And so it's slower.
way to describe that in great deal of detail. that was a low blow. I'm sorry. You've got vodka. I've got scotch. This is what happens. The thing that about that though that I think speaks specifically to the technical side of this for folks that want to get nitty gritty, the time to, like, first paint, what they call, you know, the first paint of the page, is actually can be faster for non-AMP pages as well because of the way AMP uses, when you build an AMP page, you have to include the AMP JavaScript. There is an AMP JavaScript file that, because you're going to use tags that are not native HTML tags and have very, like AMP image, which is like a lazy loaded image type thing. And that's all powered through JavaScript. But the AMP JavaScript itself delays the paint cycle. So that's one of the things, like if you look at Ferdy's article, he gets into that the time to first paint and stuff can be much faster, milliseconds, but faster for native pages if it's not being held up by some of that overhead, which is interesting because, you know, that's the argument for using it is that it's, you know, faster for that. So
yeah,
I think the question becomes, is search important enough? Because that's, I think, at this point, the main argument for using it. Do you want to show up in search results? Do you want to show up high in search results? Let me rephrase that.
Right. Yeah, they're incentivizing adoption through, like, SEO.
It is a strong-arm technique, to be sure. We already know Google factors page speed into their rankings, and this is one more component of that. And the argument today is that if Google wanted to foster a fast web, they should not tie that to AMP. It should strictly be tied to page speed only.
Yeah.
You know, you get that carousel that if And I think, I mean, if you use Google search in or on iOS, I believe the experience is the same. Yeah, on Android, when you search, you get the little carousel, and that's where, you know, that big value comes in, because not only are you shown on what we would call, I guess, the first page of results for a mobile device, but you get prime treatment, you get an image, you get, you know, a big tile. And for a lot of people, that is important.
Are they the ones in search results that show up with the little, like, lightning bolt icon?
There you go, yeah.
Okay.
The funny thing is, when you start digging into some of the research on this, there are sites that are like, oh yeah, we saw a huge increase in our readership. But then there are sites that are like, yeah, we saw a huge decrease in any kind of lead generation as a business. Because now they never end up on the site.
I just went to an article on the Next Web, and the AMP page loaded fast. And then I clicked through the regular page, and it also loaded fast. The main difference was that the AMP page still shows advertisements. And if I'm going to load a page on a separate thing, why can't I just not have it? Like, if it didn't show ads, I would be like, okay, AMP, we'll try. I know you're going to die in 4 years when Google kills you off, like Inbox and Reader, but I'll give you a try.
That was one of the big arguments early on for why AMP sucked, actually, was because it didn't support ads. And so all of these media companies were like, why would we use this product if we have no way to generate revenue through it?
Why are we letting media companies dictate, like, the direction the internet goes? That's terrible.
I mean, I get it. I do get it. If you are a media company, if you don't make money, you can't make content. I get that. I don't know what the answer is either. I don't have a good, like, recommendation in terms of what to do besides, you know, with a technology like AMP.
This is like a digression, but it, like, in-page ads seems so lazy. Like, that's print media, and we're doing it because they're too lazy to innovate new ways of revenue.
You won't get disagreement from me, but I need a better idea of what to tell them to do, and I don't have that yet. Clearly, paywalls are a bad idea, so. But
this is the kind of in-depth commentary you get on this show in the second half, folks.
Well, it comes back to control, right? Because that's what all of this, you know, okay, you're going to decide to, you know, that search is really important, that you want your stuff to show up there, but you're going to give up control. You're not going to be able to do some of the fancy lead generation things that you want. You're not going to be able to do all the fancy tracking you want. You know, the JavaScript options are incredibly limited as to what you are allowed to do. And so that limits options for interactivity, for layout. You can build a whole site on AMP technology. The AMP project website itself does that. And they are adding stuff that allows various interactivity animations, functionality. But as they are doing that, they're doing the very thing that they were designed against, which is, every time you add that, it adds weight. And they try to address it by, like, Foundation. If you use Foundation in a build process, you can go in and selectively say, you know, we don't need Orbit, we don't need Magellan, so we're not going to include those. AMP works the same way. You include the things you need. But at some point, if you really think you need all that, then why aren't you just building a really fast mobile site? Because you're going to lose all the speed advantage that AMP has to offer. And if you aren't comfortable giving up all of that control, then you're playing in a sandbox that I'm not sure is really right for you at that point.
You know, I understand that AMP has, like, CDN things tied into it, and then also just, like, its own markup framework. But the fact that, like, the pages load on, like, a shadow of the site, and it's obviously a shadow of the site, that seems disingenuous. Like if you go to a page and the AMP version of the page, I don't know.
The vodka is strong.
I
know what you're getting. I know exactly what you're getting. Let's put a pin in it. Something to say about that. But
it goes back to your lead generation idea. It's the same kind of thing. Like, you they have all this technology to try to speed things up, but really what it seems like is, like, let's get people more dependent on our cloud infrastructure.
And I think it's worth mentioning, too, that as we talk about this, adoption of AMP technology is incredibly low. They're going to tout things like, oh, well, we serve, you know, 5 billion pages through AMP now, and we've got 25 million domains that are powering, you know, that are powered by AMP in some fashion. But that, the numbers sound big, but the proportion isn't. One of the recent W3, you know, like technology usage charts pegged AMP usage or AMP application. Sorry. at 0.1%, 0.1% of websites. And as a disclaimer, we actually do use AMP on Drunken UX because I could. So I did.
We
yeah.
do?
Yeah, what? We actually do.
That's why you have to give me the Instagram password.
This is maybe an opportunity for small sites because when they launched, they very specifically partnered with like major media corporations when they launched AMP to get them to buy in and, you know, kind of serve as a technical demonstration. But those companies still, by and large, dominate that space. And you aren't seeing a lot of small websites and small media producers getting space in any of that. And I can't help but wonder, you know, if AMP really is going to benefit them or not. But I think the opportunity is there. And so this, I want to kind of emphasize this as not being all doom and gloom. I'm not all down on AMP, you know, because I do think there is opportunity. And depending on the way you work, it could be very easy to do.
It seems like it's solving a problem that doesn't exist yet, though. I think I'm just really annoyed at the whole thing that I have to click through to another link.
I share your annoyance, but I think I do have to disagree. I think Google was right, whether or not they were altruistic in that. I think their emphasis that we want a technology that allows us to serve very fast, very lightweight mobile pages, I think is absolutely a correct way of thinking. Now, whether or not that is self-serving to them is another argument. But if
the reason that your page loads, like, remember when we did the weather episode, episode 17, and but you go to like AccuWeather and the page, if you turn on ad blocker and you block all of the third party ad sources, the page loads pretty quickly. But if you don't, it takes forever because of all the ads. If Google actually wants, has it in their interest to have mobile pages load more quickly, then they shouldn't have it not display ads on the mobile pages.
Yeah, and I think that's a philosophical argument that doesn't have a good answer.
It's a
practical
one.
I get it. I totally get it.
Yeah.
But I
think that what they're saying that they're trying to accomplish is not completely congruent with their implementation strategy.
Google still has to make money too, mind you, and an ad network is part of their revenue stream, so they can't not do it. But we can. We can build a site that doesn't have to conform to those things. And I think that's the takeaway is the argument that we should be building super fast, super lean mobile experiences, I think is a message that carries over completely and
I would
totally
agree with that. Yeah, definitely.
You know, remember jQuery Mobile?
Yeah.
Man. That package was revolutionary when it came out, but it was also a huge JavaScript library.
Right.
You know, and we started thinking about these things and responsive design in ways that make our sites better, but we're still very reliant on our, you know, responsive design doesn't mean you load less, usually. Images, of course, you can do different, you know, trickery and stuff, but it generally still means you load most of your site. And this idea that maybe we should reconsider that, I think, is a argument worth having, and maybe that's a topic we can dive into, you know, on a future episode of what the right mobile strategy is. From a technical standpoint, because I think that's an important part of this discussion, I mentioned, like, we have it on Drunken UX, our pages are AMP powered because we use WordPress, and there are many, you know, WordPress plugins. I think we're using the native one at this point. There are
I didn't I didn't see the AMP page. I searched Drunken UX and I found a bunch of our articles, but I didn't see the AMP link.
It's, I think...
Like, it doesn't have the lightning bolt.
No, I think what you have to do is, like, if you click on one of our pages, you add a slash AMP to it or something like that. Yeah, we're definitely running it. It is the native, the one word, like, the WordPress itself AMP plugin.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. It may only apply actually to our blog post. I don't know if it applies to custom post types or not. That's a different deal. But what it means is you can't display AMP content from the page. You have to have a separate URI for it. And so that means double presentation, and it means different presentation. And like you had pointed out,
mm-hmm.
talking about like the shadow display, so to speak.
Yeah.
It doesn't look the same because you can't make it look the same for the most part. It can be very close, but you are limited in what your options are, what CSS you can use, what JavaScript you can use. So you have to pare it down.
Right.
So that means you either completely rebuild your site in AMP, or you offer secondary presentation for the pieces of content that you want to show up in AMP. And that's a pretty big technical ask for a lot of websites, especially if you don't know it. I think the other thing, when we talk about control, when we talk about all of these things, you know, if it's just you, that's one consideration. But if you're working at a company and you have a marketing department and you have designers, you know, or design team that are working on things, you also have to consider those implications, because the AMP has very specific technical limitations that a marketer may not like, you know, as far as being able to show a certain thing or, you know, do a certain thing, or design, or being able to make a certain interaction exist.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, those are
picky about that.
Those are big things to consider that can impact if you've got, you know, people who have very specific tastes and very, you know, need an outcome to be very this way.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's something to consider. And if that's okay, and if you make them understand that, then by all means, again, I'm going to refer back. Implementing AMP at a basic level is easy and fairly straightforward if you have a CMS and you know what you're doing. And if that's the case, you know what? Go ahead, do it. Whatever. Doing it at a really deep level is another story, and you have to consider those kinds of things. The thing that pisses me off.
The one thing? The only thing that pisses you off?
The only thing that pisses me off. I mentioned this on Twitter ages ago, and I'll try to dig up the tweet. I think it was last year sometime. AMP, if you go look at the AMP specification, there are very specific requirements for how the content gets presented. That's in the spec. That's the reason this exists. And there are two of those. One has to do with pop-ups, or pop-overs or overlays. This got to be a big deal, like with, yeah, even in just mobile search in general, they were, you know, downgrading search results if you covered X amount of the screen. You know how some mobile sites would put like a go download our app banner across the top of their page if they thought you were on a mobile device. You know, they got really hard-nosed on that and were telling people, don't do that. You know, that's, they can't get to your content. You know, it's bad. So the Wall Street Journal, their AMP articles have both a pop-up that tells you to subscribe, and they only include part of the article. Those are both direct violations of part of the AMP spec. And I don't know why they are allowed to do that. That inconsistency kind of bothers me.
I think that gets back to my point earlier about how their statement about serving mobile pages as fast as possible is inconsistent with still showing advertisements.
Yeah. And I don't know if like the Wall Street Journal is just getting away with it because nobody has called him out on it or whatever. I called him out on it.
On January 12th
of this year.
This year,
it was 9 months ago. So, but And I had a screenshot in that tweet, so I will, I'll throw that in too, because I want you to see kind of what that looks like. Because it makes the page unusable on a mobile device. And that's counterintuitive to the whole thing. And so it just throws so many questions out there as to what you get away with, what you can't get away with, what's allowed, what isn't allowed. This all kind of comes down to a head that AMP has a future. We don't know what that future is, but we know what Google wants that future to be. They want to add AMP powering to email, and they want to add AMP powering to a thing that they are creating called Stories, quote unquote.
Right.
Nobody really knows what Stories are yet. They keep comparing them to like Snapchat Stories, like, you know, a collection of articles that get displayed in like a form, a carousel type format. They haven't been implemented in search yet, and we're not really sure where else they might be implemented. But the idea is that it's going to be this part of the spec that allows you to combine articles together in some kind of grouped fashion. The email piece is more interesting, and oddly enough, we've managed to tie together our two starter topics quite a bit tonight, actually. In Gmail, what they want to do is allow you to do fancier emails, basically. I mean, that's all there is to it. They right. want to give you more options for email marketing, more options for like interactive power. You know, if you want to, you know, reply to an event from inside an email, they want to give you that power. But I mean, that only helps you inside of Gmail. It's still email, you know, at the baseline.
Right.
And one would assume that whatever they're doing degrades in a way that other email clients will see like a basic thing. But that's where things get scary for me. And we get back to this argument of control, and we get this argument of, is Google doing what's good for Google or what's good for us? Because if that's only helping Gmail, that's not necessarily good for everybody.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know where that goes. You know, the email spec is still in sort of pre-production. The story spec is still kind of unknown.
Are they going to be, like, with Inbox, are they going to be improving Gmail at all? Or is it just, like, thanks for all the fish, here's a shit pile back?
That's
up
to them to figure out at that point. I am not the Google. If I was the Google, I would not be trying to scrape my dimes together to run a podcast that I lose money on. This show costs me money.
Okay, I'm going back to Pine.
So yeah, let us know. Are you using AMP on your websites? Have you installed the WordPress plugin or Drupal plugin or, you know, whatever platform you're using at that point? Do you think it's useful? Do you think it's fast? Do you like it on your Android device? Do you think Aaron should figure out a way to make our AMP implementation better for us?
What?
Give you some work to do. I do everything, damn it. I built that site with my bare hands.
I'm asking you for the Instagram password.
Damn it, stop asking for that.
How else am I? I gotta get my kicks in now before the EU makes stupid copyright laws. And I can't chapter 13 my memes anymore on my Google Amps.
Fine, I'll get you taken care of.
Oh.
If you see our Instagram do weird shit, then no, it ain't me. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in. Let us know what you thought of this episode. And if you like the format, the little difference in how we approach things. I know there was a lot crammed in, especially the second half of the amp, and that we didn't dive like super deep into the implementation stuff, but we're certainly happy to revisit that in a future episode. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you think about the EU Copyright Directive. Let us know what you think about Inbox going away. We would love to hear any of your thoughts on any of that stuff.
You might say that we modulated the amplitude of this podcast. Thanks for listening.
I know that's a joke, but if I don't know from what.
Amplitude modulation.
God damn it.
If you like horrible jokes and me trolling Michael with horrible jokes, be sure to connect with us on Facebook and Twitter /DrunkenUX. And also come chat with us on Slack. DrunkenUX.com/Slack.
Oh yeah, Slack. I think that is a joke from something though, that you know, that or a song or something about modulating the amplitude, because it's pretty, you know, audio amplitude, whatever. I'm gonna shame myself for that because oops. Folks, join us every Wednesday for a new episode of Real Time over in the middle of the month when we now do rebuild process.
Wait, what is the Instagram site again? It's DrunkenUX Podcast.
Yes, DrunkenUX Podcast. Somebody has DrunkenUX. Okay. I could maybe ask them if they would give it to me. I don't know. We'll see. I don't
never.
Know. Yeah, new Real Time over to you every Wednesday. Except the middle of the month. Build process now comes to you on a new schedule. We mix that in. Our last episode was a sit down with Rachel Cherry, who has helped set up the UP campus. She used to work in higher ed. She used to work for Disney. She now is a freelancer. Some great stuff there. Go check that out. That was episode number 4. And we'll have another episode coming to you in October. Aaron, go to bed, because it's getting late for us here in this part of the world.
Yeah.
We look forward to talking to y'all, and I guess until next time, I only have one thing to say, and that is to keep your personas close and your users closer. Take care.